Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. This is Michael W. Dean. Today our guest is Bill Buprit. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great, Michael. It's an honor to be on your show again.
Excellent. Yeah, we really got a lot of good feedback from last time we were there. You're in the Middle East, and it is 11:30 p.m. here in Wyoming. What time is it there in the Middle East?
It's 1000 hours.
Oh, I thought it was... So why is it half hours off somewhere, some places there instead of hours off?
Because of the shape of the countries is such that if it's a north-south line to determine the time zone, the shape of the country will determine whether it's on the hour or the half hour, so that a limited number of time zones are needed.
Okay. Well, I only have three questions, and this is going to be like a 45 to 60 minute interview. So we have two more questions for you to talk about for 58 minutes. You wrote an article recently about repealing the Second Amendment, and I really like the premise of it. And I wonder if you went for a little shock value with the title of it, because it sounds like something that would be on the Huffington Post or on the, you know, a petition on the White House site of gun grabbers. What was it called?
It was called Repeal the Second Amendment, just like it sounds. And I certainly did want some shock value to it. And as a preamble, I think those who have read my site, and I think we may have discussed this before, Michael, when I was on your show, I am not a constitutionalist. I am an abolitionist and a confederationist, and I think that the Constitution completely sunk any ability that we had in 1791 to have a free nation.
I'm a recovering constitutionalist.
Hi, my name is Bill.
Hi, Bill. Welcome. Were you a recovering constitutionalist? Were you ever a constitutionalist?
Oh my gosh, I drank the Kool-Aid for most of my adult life.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny, this path that we have to, some may refer to it as anarchism. I like to use the word abolitionism because, and you and I are on the same page, Michael, in that we seek to liberate humanity from all forms of slavery, not only chattel, but also regulatory and tax slavery, because in the end, self-ownership is king. The non-initiation of violence is something that we all want to see, but you can't have that in the present circumstances, and the Constitution did nothing more than codify, in very wily and cunning language, a new kind of plantation.
Do you believe the theory put forth by Boston Tea Party and others that there were two camps in writing the Constitution, and one of them was more into freedom and the other tried to put weasel words in, the people he called the founding lawyers, like Hamilton?
I am proud to call Kenneth Royce, a.k.a. Boston Tea Party, a friend. He and I correspond, and we've met each other at speaking engagements together, and I would say that it was Hologram of Liberty, Kenneth Royce's book, also known as Boston Tea Party, but under that particular book, it was Kenneth Royce. Ken did precisely what you say. He said the Anti-Federalists and the Confederationists and the original authors of the Articles of Confederation, and some would even say the Declaration of Independence, even though I'm convinced that Thomas Paine wrote that and not Thomas Jefferson, even though Jefferson took the credit for it. The Anti-Federalists were absolutely terrified, because in 1783, 13 nation states had gone to Paris to sue for peace and accept conditions of surrender, more or less, from England to vacate the colonies. 13 separate nation states, not the United States. A mere 4 years later, we have this confabulation of founding lawyers who show up in Philadelphia behind closed doors for months at a time, losing almost 40% of their membership during that time because so many objected to what they saw happening, because we had just fought off the shackles for 8 bloody years from the United Kingdom. And what a lot of observers were seeing was that the very shackles that we have just shed were going to be put on through a domestic confabulation.
What was the other word you used for yourself? Confederatist?
Confederationist, because of the Articles of Confederation.
Can you explain that for people who aren't familiar with it?
I can. The Articles of Confederation came around in 1781, expired in 1787. They had been around since 1776 and were germinated as a result of the war with England, in which they wanted to have some kind of confederation, cantonships, some kind of loose aggregation of states so they could get together and fight the common foe, which at the time was England. If you go on Google and you look either on my site or when I used to write for Lou Rockwell, I wrote an article that was called The God That Failed, and it concerns how the Constitution was quite literally a political coup that occurred in 1787, because the charter of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was to revise the Articles of Confederation. They did not revise the Articles of Confederation. What they did is they threw them out the window, closed the doors, and came up with this fabulous Washington Hamiltonian bankster national government, national gun in the hands of the central government confab that we suffer under today.
What kind of comments and remarks have you gotten from your Repeal the Second Amendment article?
You know, I get the usual hate mail, of course, from the usual suspects, most of whom I find to be conservatives more so than liberals. And if I may, Michael, very quickly, I find, like the word unconstitutional, it has no descriptive value. I will rarely use the word conservative or liberal beyond this point, because most people are familiar with that. I use the term collectivist and individualist, and I use the preamble of interventionist and non-interventionist. I am a non-interventionist individualist. I presume that you are a non-interventionist individualist. Interventionist collectivists are most of the political classes. As a matter of fact, I remember writing an article several years ago where I said that political science and the study thereof is basically a death cult. Because riddle yourself this: can a political science professor speak for even a minute, much less 60 minutes, during a lecture if he is not rationalizing the initiation of force against people?
Not in state universities.
Can't do it. Can't do it. Now, there are some exceptions, like some of the fellows that I've met at Porkfest and such who are academics, but the handful of them compared to the hundreds of thousands of tenured academics who provide that sophisticated academic rationalization for terror, tyranny, and what in the end is a death cult. Those are the times we live in, Michael.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people who are experts in something that is wrong. I mean, most economists, I think, would fall into that class.
That's a splendid summation, by the way.
What's that?
I think that's a splendid summation, by the way.
Yeah, it's...
things that are wrong.
It's not terribly eloquent, but... when it came out of my mouth, I kind of said, hey, that's good. I should write that down.
Well, it's terribly eloquent, Michael.
Experts in things that are wrong. Maybe we should put that into the title of this somehow, a discussion on
experts
in things that are wrong. And the other day I said a sort of corollary to that. I was watching MSNBC and I said that the lady was speaking in the tone of voice you'd use to talk to a child you're lying to. And she was talking about economics. She was talking about how the Cypriot government just stole 10% of everyone's savings. And the teaser was, how would you like to wake up and find that the banks had taken 10% of your money? After the break, we'll find out why this happened and how it may have saved a whole continent. I mean, she really was talking like that. I've heard that kind of talking to a child that you're lying to logic on the news, but that was the first time I'd really heard the tone that people use when they're talking to children.
You know, you're a braver man than I. I cannot stomach without an air sickness bag watching any television, and we haven't had television in the house for 18 years now.
Well, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Indeed.
Somebody's got to keep an eye on them. I mean, I've actually... with the Freedom Fiends, Neiman and I have been tending away from talking about politics, because in the 2 years we've been doing this, you know, starting March 30th will be our two-year anniversary, and we're doing it three times a week, and we're getting syndicated on radio soon. And once we are, we're not going to have a lot of guests, but we do want to have you as a guest on a segment at some point. But
well, I'd be honored.
Yeah, thank you. We'd be honored to have you. But when we started doing it, there weren't a lot of podcasts talking on a daily basis about what's wrong with the world politically. And now in that 2 years, a lot have come forth We've had something to do with some of it, and one thing we do is give people a lot of audio advice and tech advice to make them sound better. But we kind of feel like, why should anarchists talk about politics all the time and complain about the government? I mean, it kind of has to be done, but you know, we'd rather talk about what we'd be doing in LibPair. We do movie reviews more than we talk about politics sometimes, because that's fun.
Well, you know, Michael, I actually think that this whole juxtaposition of politics animating so much of our conversation as anarchists and abolitionists and those of us who wish to divorce ourselves from the state, the bifurcation is the fact that we don't want the political model to rule our lives in any fashion, because what we want is we want a world with rules, but a world without rulers. I think it was Edward Abbey who said that grown men don't need leaders. Now, I don't know if I buy into that completely, because there are certain voluntarist organizations out there in which leadership is essential to make them work effectively. I have no doubt of that, but they're completely voluntary commitments. And what I find in politics is that sort of the distillate and the silver bullet to determine if freedom is the end state that they seek is, do I have the opportunity to opt out and raise my hand and say, you know, I'm not going to participate in this anymore? If I have that opportunity, I'm truly free. If I don't, I am not. And I can't think of a political system that's in place right now in which that opportunity to opt out is realistic.
Yeah. We were joking at the beginning about a recovery program for statism, introducing ourselves as recovering constitutionalists. And I'm looking at your blog post now, Repeal the Second Amendment, and it's got Uncle Sam pointing to a simple 12-step program that will change America's gun culture, which is 12 steps, and they're all repeal the Second Amendment. I actually went through AA. I'm still sober. I don't go to meetings anymore, but I learned a lot from it, not just from the steps, but from the traditions. And I actually think that the 12 traditions of AA are a really good blueprint for anybody who wants to run an ad hoc voluntary organization that it has a primary purpose, is self-supporting, has a political structure, but is completely voluntary. Anybody can walk away at any time. And things aren't really done with a vote. They're done with a group conscience, which is sort of a cross between a vote and a discussion and talking about it until the group kind of agrees on something. The founder of AA actually, in that book written in the 50s, described it as a synergy of democracy and anarchy, which to me, you know, to most people sounds like the best thing in the world and the worst thing in the world. But democracy isn't bad when it's not backed by force, when you are free to leave, and it is a, you know, a place where you are free to leave.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the case. Now, it's interesting because there was a fellow by the name of Bradford who published a magazine that went completely electronic several years ago called Liberty out of Washington State. And he had an article on that very thing where he said that AA was a great example of that kind of organization in which spontaneous order and effective end states marry each other in a very Rothbardian fashion. And I think it's a great model for other things. You know, I happen to be a member of a group of friends, and we're preparing for worse contingencies than can be seen today. We think that economic collapse is imminent, and we think that proper preparation towards that is pretty critical in these times. And we all have our own separate skill sets and talents that we bring to the organization, and by coming together, we achieve that synergy that you're talking about. We sort of optimize our talents by getting together on a voluntary basis and being able to yield to what somebody's wise about and something that I'm wise about, and we can all benefit from that at the same time.
What do you think would be gained by repealing the Second Amendment, and do you think it can actually happen?
I don't think it can actually happen. And if you'll note in the essay when I wrote it, one of the things I talked about was we talk about racial matters in the U.S., and I think that nothing could bring racial matters in the United States to a greater head than reparations. And the analogy that I was making is that if you and I are forced to pay for slavery reparations for people who are long dead to existing human beings now, whose lineage may be traced back, if possible, to those who were in chattel slavery, because the reparations movement was very specific about not including the 10 to 14 years of indentured slavery that brought so many people of all races across the Atlantic and below the Mexican border, 95% of all slaves that crossed the Atlantic went below the Mexican border into Latin America. And they suffered under horrific conditions, not to say that horrific conditions did not exist within the chattel slavery regime until it was abolished in the United States. My whole idea behind saying repeal the Second Amendment is that I am so sick to death. I'm a man of the gun. I've been around guns all my life. I've spent my whole adult life around them professionally. I carry all the time. And what really aggravates me is there are supposedly 30,000 gun laws on the books. I have adduced that there are approximately 500 gun laws from which localities, counties, and states emanate their own gun laws that come from those, but there's 300 to 500 basic gun laws. These gun laws violate the very nature, spirit, and precise text of the Second Amendment in the Constitution. Yet, again and again, they are rubber stamped by the courts. They are rubber stamped in the 1934 National Firearms Act. If you read 1939 U.S. v. Miller, if you look at the 1968 Gun Control Act, if you look at the 1984 McClure-Volkmer Act, all of these infringements, from top to bottom, right to left, these infringements are extraordinarily thorough, yet they've been tolerated in both the court systems and by the American people. So the point that I'm trying to make with repeal the Second Amendment is, if we want disarmament, let's go. Stop simmering me in water, waiting for it to come to a boil. Stop killing me with 1,000 needles and pinpricks. Let's just take this decision and in one fell dramatic swoop, make it so. And then, once they repeal the Second Amendment, the usual suspects, the cops in this case, are going to be sent out to seize them and to confiscate them. And I think that that itself would set a chain of conflagration that would not only shake America to its core, but I think it would rip it asunder.
Do you think that'd be a good thing? Or do you just want to, you'd know what's going to happen eventually and want to get it over with, or something else?
You're asking a deep philosophical question that appears simple on its face when you say to you, that would be a good thing. Because, Michael, in the end, none of us want violence. Yeah. But I also know that pacifism is a perfect pathway to extinction. I am a porcupine. You are a porcupine. We want to be lethal beings if messed with, but we don't want to be lethal beings by initiating force against others. That's what distinguishes you and I from the rest of humanity, it appears to me, is the fact that we have crossed this philosophical Rubicon in which we've said, we are not going to be pawns in your game, and if you push us far enough, we're going to make sure that we provide you with the kind of disincentives that will stop you from doing that in the future. So is it a good thing to see 500, 5,000, 50,000 states or smaller devolved disaggregation of the United States than it is now? My answer is absolutely yes. I don't want the recipe to be violence, but can we continue doing what we're doing and have a peaceful and prosperous future? No, we cannot.
Well, Boston Tea Party did say all fish wriggle when caught. Talking about people complaining and just complaining. And complaining and complaining. So I guess your repeal the Second Amendment title was kind of your modest proposal.
It was a modest proposal. It was a bit, well, one can say that it was a bit of a stretch, as Swift would have us use, I guess you can call it the theater of the absurd, to bring things into focus because I can't shake people enough to get them to pay attention.
Yeah. Let's take a little break and go sell some things in the pure market, and we'll be right back.
Did your world collapse when Ron Paul didn't win? Don't keep hoping for some great man to fix government through government. Complete your evolution today to full-on anarcho-capitalist. Reward your brain with the freedom fiends and quit breaking your heart with some politician. While the libertarians argue,
but who would build the roads?
The freedom fiends have already built the roads and moved on to making the great media content of the libertarian paradise. Freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
Want to contribute to liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com.
Welcome back to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. This is Michael W. Dean. We're interviewing Bill Bupert. Bupert. Why do I have a problem with that, man? I try to make it French, you know, or Frenchier than it is.
Everybody has that problem, and please don't feel bad about it. It's Bupert in the American language, but it's Bupert in the French patois.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about hope for the future, but let's save that for the third act, the redemption in the third act.
Okay.
And I know you're an expert on, more so than most people, on where the near future's possibly headed, but I don't want to go there because it depresses me.
Well, so you're very kind, but I think that you're going to be surprised by my remarks in the third act.
Okay. Does that mean there's no hope or there's a lot of hope?
No, there's a lot of hope.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. Well, we could just have two acts, 40 minutes of hope. If you could do 40 minutes of hope, man, I'm down for it.
Now, I can't do 40 minutes of total hope because there's pain to achieve some of that hope, but there is certainly hope.
All right. Well, let's talk about when the Constitution got subverted. What was the first, you know, I mean, a lot of people say, we need to take America back to the Constitution. And I'm like, what? The 50s? Segregation? You know, Vietnam? World War One? Where do you want to, you know, when was the perfect America?
I am so amused by that question. As I mentioned earlier, Michael, I said that the word unconstitutional has no descriptive value. I would say the word constitutional has no descriptive value. Your show and number of shows have covered so much the predations that the present federal government has taken against its citizens. This is nothing new. You look at World War One. You look at all the wars that we fought overseas. You look at our income tax rates. You look at the war of self-immolation that we fought from 1861 to 65. You look at the fact that in 1791, when Rhode Island had finally been muscled into ratifying the Constitution, and that document was ratified, within 3 years, Washington, at the head of a national army, is marching on tax protesters. Within 7 years, the Alien Seditions Act comes out from the presidency, in which they say that if you criticize the federal government or say things that we don't think are very nice, we will jail you. And of course, what that means is we will fine you, we will jail you. But it also speaks to this lethality ladder that we have in the United States that is constitutional, which is cops. Absent cops, no political bad actor on earth over all five millennia of recorded history could do squat to deprive one individual of their freedom and liberty. What that means is that if cops don't have the ability to fine you, kidnap you, cage you, maim you, or kill you, no threats or actual acts of initiated violence exist to enforce the tens of thousands of bad laws that are on the books in the United States, much less all over the planet. And what the Constitution did is that, you asked a little earlier, you said, when did the Constitution become what it is? The moment Alexander Hamilton opened his mouth for the first time at the Constitutional Convention, it was written in stone what would happen. What happened is those 13 nation states, which would soon become 50 over time, those were political sub-agencies of the federal government because Washington wanted a gun in the hands of the national state so that he could reach over the borders of the state and extract wealth and resources from individuals and direct those individuals through regulation to behave in the manner in which the federal government approved. That is what the Constitution is about. From start to finish, it is about nothing else. You may find it curious, Michael, that whenever you and I find ourselves in court, if we ever have that misfortune, you will not refer to the body of the Constitution to defend your individual liberties. You will refer to the Bill of Rights, which were originally 200, which were reduced to 12, which were eventually reduced to 10, with the initial Constitutional Convention, which was ratified by 1791. But in the end, the Constitution isn't about limiting government. The Constitution is about putting in this very sophisticated organism that grows over time. I wrote a book called Zero Gov, Limited Government, Unicorns, and Other Mythological Creatures, which is available on Amazon, and you can find it on ZeroGov.com, which is my site. The point that I'm making is that for the longest time, like you, I drank the constitutional Kool-Aid, and I said those two words, limited government. It flew out of my mouth with a plum, and I really didn't know what I was talking about, and I admit that now. So I finally sat down one day and I said, okay, limited government, I have so many people who say, okay, Bill, show me how limited government functions, and I said, I'm going to show them how that functions. And guess what? After pretty thorough historical research, I'm not a professional historian. I consider myself an amateur historian, and I pay attention to what I read, and I read more than one book or author about a given subject. There's no such thing as limited government. I have no historical precedent, antecedent, example that I can show you, Michael, where a government erects itself from either the ashes of a former government or on a new continent and restrains its excesses against the individual citizens that it oversees within its tax jurisdiction. No animal has ever existed, which is what brought me on board to include my oldest son, who helped me cross that philosophical Rubicon, where I decided that the only government that is rational, right, and virtuous is self-government.
Do you know, do you ever listen to or are you aware of a podcaster named Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker?
I am. I've been on Ben's show, and he was very kind to have me on. So, yes, I am.
He's about the only guy I listen to audio-wise these days. I really love what he's doing.
He does a great job.
Yep.
You both.
Shucks. Interesting, though, I don't know if you know this about him. He has a similar experience to you where he taught his offspring about limited government. And then when she was an adult, she took him all the way to, hey, wait, you're making arguments here for the government is bad. So the government should only do really important things, and took him the last way.
Well, I'm going to talk to Ben about that. I'll have to email him today or tomorrow and mention it to him, because he had not mentioned that to me when I was on his son. But yeah, my oldest son, who is now 25, he got married recently in Indonesia. We all went there for the marriage. And he just graduated. No, he's graduating in 2 months with a mechanical engineering MS, moving to Washington State. But he is the reason why I finally made that leap. And the nice thing about making this leap, though, Michael, for you and I, and if we can call this loose confab that you and I are members of in the abolitionist anarchist movement a movement, is that once you get here, you can't go back.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who used to be statists and are now not statists, but not many people go back. There are people who were small government libertarians when they were young and then, quote unquote, grew up and became conservatives or liberals. The guy who does that horrible show on MSNBC, Hodball with Chris Matthews. That guy's one of them.
He's a horrific human being.
He really is. But he was interviewing Ron Paul one time and said, I used to be a libertarian. I liked Barry Goldwater. Then I grew up. I don't know how libertarian Barry Goldwater was. His idea of ending the Vietnam War was to nuke Vietnam. But somewhat.
I hail from the state of Arizona. But it's interesting when you hear people say that. Well, what he's basically saying is he's rationalizing being a mugger. Yeah, I'm an economist by training, and what I've discovered is that for either you or anybody in your audience who has ever had to suffer through a conventional economics course, what you finally arrive at after self-elucidation is that macroeconomics, Keynesianism, monetarism, Marxism, the Lachman School of Austrian economics, they are nothing more than a sophisticated academic rationalization for government theft. That's all it is. When you strip away all the bunting and you strip away all the sophisticated language, that's what it's all about, is rationalizing the economic arena, the initiation of force.
I know it's hard to put on a minarchist hat and picture it from their viewpoint, but can you do that for a sec, or does that hurt too much?
No, it doesn't hurt too much. As a matter of fact, we should all do that. We have to look at this as a prism and a Rubik's Cube, and if we can't take the position of who our opponents or near opponents may be, we can't really see how their thought processes work. Because in the end, and a slight sidebar here, in the end, there's no such thing as objectivity. Everybody has confirmation biases. Everybody is biased. But if you unlock all those secret doors in your mind and all the doors that you've trained and all the tools that you've used to think critically, what you discover is that you sure have biases, but if you can identify your own biases and identify the biases of the author, you can get a much more accurate picture of what the truth is than if you do this pie-in-the-sky business. To me, objectivity is like limited government. It doesn't exist, it won't exist, and it will never exist. So please, I'll don my I'll don my minarchist dunce cap.
Mine's a dunce cap with a fedora feather in it. It's fancy. So here's my question. What the hell happened to the anti-war left? They were screaming in the streets 5 years ago. What happened to them?
I'll tell you what, that is astonishing to me. Because when, you know, it's so common for those of us, I voted Republican once, and I was Republican for a very brief period of time, and I would hear from the Democrats, they'd say, oh, you Republicans are war lovers. And I get that. I think they're onto something, because when I look back in history, that's certainly the case. But then again, when I look back in history, what I find is that the Democrats started World War I, the Democrats started World War II, the Democrats started the Korean War, the Democrats started the Vietnam War, and it was Clinton who made sure that we got engaged in Somalia, in Haiti, and in Greater Serbia to fight conflicts that had nothing whatsoever to do with even the grossest rationalization of American national security.
Democrats start wars. Democrats start wars and Republicans end them, which isn't to say Republicans are great, because they drive it into the ground for a long time before they end them.
I think you're right, but it would bear a historical look to also look at how much Republicans spend, because Republicans spend just as much as Democrats do, and they're able to rationalize the war effort. But then again, Obama came in 2008, and one thing that I found enlightening about him is I thought, well, he's got a real anti-war lilt to his language. I mean, he seems to really want to get us out of the Middle East. Yet, not only did he remain in Iraq, not only did he remain in Afghanistan, he expanded the conflict to Libya, he expanded the conflict to the Sudan, he expanded the conflict to the Horn of Africa, he expanded it to Yemen, now he's trying that with Syria. And one note about Libya that I found fascinating is that what we saw there was not a codified, but an overt overthrow of a leader and looking the other way or providing aid and assistance to see that leader assassinated. Now, in 1975, there were the church hearings. All nation states have used assassination at one point or another. The thing that I find interesting about that is that, in my mind, if a nation state engages in war, I think that all members of the political class should be recognized by the Geneva and Hague Conventions and international laws of land warfare as active combatants during the entirety of the campaign. And what we did to Libya with Gaddafi opens the door to make that case in a legal fashion.
It also makes the case for it's not a good idea to be friends with the United States. It'll come back to bite you in the butt, literally, and kill you.
That is the truth. As far as your original question, what happened to the anti-war left? I think that once their special interest got the reins of power and the $1 billion was spent to see who would get hold of this $16 trillion debt and the $4 trillion acknowledged spending that the Congress has and the President has and the executive agencies, they shut up because they see that the almost $1 trillion that we spend on the military, to include contingency funding, actual DOD funding, intelligence funding, and the DOE funding programs for nuclear weaponry, which amounts to about $1 trillion, and the $3 trillion that we've spent in Iraq, and the $1 trillion plus that we've spent in Afghanistan, and then Lord knows the tens or hundreds of billion dollars that we've spent on the other neo-imperialist ventures around the planet, that's big money. And when you have money like that, money can buy silence. And I think that's what's happened.
Well, I mean, we had anti-war left in the 60s. You know, the hippies weren't yelling, hey, hey, Republicans, how many kids did you kill today? They were yelling at LBJ. And those same kids grew up and elected Obama, basically. I guess they forgot.
Two observations about that, though, Michael, and that's this. In 1972, when conscription went away, the anti-war movement evaporated. And the other thing that's interesting is that today, with the anti-war left, I think what they've discovered, who was the fellow who ran against, he didn't necessarily run against Ron Paul, he's married to a 6-foot-tall, red-headed Celtic goddess.
And he looks like a troll. Kucinich, man.
Kucinich. Kucinich has it all right when it comes to foreign policy because he doesn't want to export violence abroad. I get that.
Yeah.
But Kucinich is more than willing to impose violence in a broad measure domestically in order to make his socialist programs and program work. And I think that there's an intellectual dissonance in the left where some of them, if they dig deep enough as collectivists, they discover that making war at home can be consonant with making war abroad if they want to be philosophically consistent, if that makes sense.
Well, I think all collectivists, well, that's speaking collectively, a lot of collectivists seem to me to be willing to have aggression used if it gets done what they want done and doesn't do what they don't want done.
Because they practice their compassion by spending their neighbor's money at the point of a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those hippies.
Well, hey, have you been to a pork fest yet, Michael?
No, I haven't.
You need to go to a pork fest. If you can make it through the clouds of marijuana smoke and all the other stuff that's there, what a great experience, because at the beginning of the 60s, there was a right fork and a left fork, and the hippies took the left fork. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of crunchy, organic, raw, rethinking hippies out there who are saying, you know what? Libertarianism, anarchism, abolitionism, that is another path for us to explore. And I think that more and more of them are exploring. I think Jeff Berwick from Dollar Vigilante wrote an article shortly after going to Pork Fest in which he spoke to that. And he said, I discovered a new species, anarcho-hippies. And by the way, I was the keynote speaker at Pork Fest last year, and my speech was on secession, and you can find it under media and interviews on my blog, zerogov.com, if anybody's interested. But I thought it was a pretty scintillating speech, if I may say so myself.
Nice. Yeah, I've listened to a lot of the speeches from there. I've kind of been to Pork Fest virtually through the internet. I was calling Ben Stone every day on the phone and talking to him for a half hour and having him tell me what was going on. I know that doesn't equal being there. But basically, my wife doesn't get a lot of days off for work, and I don't want to go without her, so we haven't gone yet.
Sure.
But my favorite, and the Pork Fest people, they do great business, but they need to get some 79-cent foam windscreens to put on their microphones, because every speech I see on there, the content is great, the audio is pretty darn good, the video is good, but it's going pop, 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 every time they say a P or a B, and like a 79-cent... foam wind sock like I'm using on my mic right now gets rid of that.
Well, you need to send that to Carla Garrickey.
I'm sending it to her by saying it on the internet. Doesn't that just end up in her mailbox somehow? It should. That's how it works.
I will make sure Carla hears of your technical advice.
Yeah, although they should buy a couple dozen of them, because you want to change them after each speaker, because the pot smoke might intoxicate the non-pot smoking speakers. Yeah, my favorite leftist, or not leftist, my favorite hippie anarchist, I think, has got to be Vermin Supreme. You know that guy?
I do not know. Who is that?
He is a guy.
Is he related to the Supreme guy in Idiocracy?
No, not Burrito Supreme. I'll send you a picture of Vermin Supreme. He's a guy who runs for office and actually gets into primary, what is it called, arguments when they have the politicians up there? Debates. And basically runs on absolute anarchist parodies. Like, if elected, I will buy everyone a pony. I will make it illegal to not brush your teeth 3 times a day. Things like that. And he looks like Gandalf, man. He's like 60 and has long gray hair down to his butt, and he wears a boot on his head as a crown.
Look, I think there's a tremendous amount to be said for humor, and I'm not the guy who's as witty as the next when it comes to, you know, being funny and comedic and such, but I think there's a whole lodestone to be mined for that, to use for the movement, as far as making fun of the government.
Yep. If I can't laugh at your evolution, I don't want any part of it. So We covered hippies. We covered, I'm sending you a picture of Vermin Supreme. I don't know if you're on email right now, but he's pretty awesome.
Excellent. Good.
Yep. So guns. Why do you like guns?
Well, I like guns because they're liberty's teeth. I like them because I spent my whole adult life around them. I like them because we tend to be creatures on whom violence is visited, whether by government or non-government affiliated criminals and such, and it gives us a singular ability to take the person, to include women, who are not as genetically endowed as men to equalize a situation in which they are being preyed upon. It's the difference between being predator and being prey, or on as far as we're concerned, I would consider you and I sheepdogs because we don't seek to foment violence, but we do seek to disincentivize any violence visited upon us by making it very painful to do so. Guns are fascinating. Guns are tools. They're freighted with legend and apocrypha. The technology's fascinating. Right now I'm dabbling in the ability to get a 14 to 1800 meter rifle, and we keep pressing the envelope for that kind of thing. Guns allow us to defend our freedom and liberty from 3 meters to 1500 meters, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
Excellent. It's basically rocket science you can hold in your pocket.
Precisely. It is. And you know what else is fascinating about it is that in America, before the 1934 National Firearms Act, which pretty much made it illegal and registered all machine guns in these United States, we were the world's leader in technology for fully automatic firearms. You'll notice, whether one calls it correlative or causative, after 1934, not so much. There were other countries that came to the fore to do that. And I think what happened was, by stymieing the housebound garage inventors, by not taking advantage of this terrific atomization of technology enhancement that takes place on an everyday basis with full auto firearms, by making them illegal, we retarded progress in that. But high-capacity magazines, the accoutrement that's used to carry magazines, sight improvements, weapons improvements, anything that could be done legally in the United States, you'll find that there are always a huge variety of technology enhancements that are happening on a yearly basis when it comes to guns.
Excellent. All right, Bill, let's take a little break here to go sell some things in the pure market, and then we'll be back for the redemption in the third act.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get State Speech is Hate Speech, Anarchy Gumbo, Guns and Weed, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $10 for 5 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
Bill, were you cocking a gun or opening a soda?
That was a soda.
All right. Do you like that term, the pure market? I've been seeing how that one works out.
I do like that term. You know what? I love specificity in language because I think it clears so many things up. I tend to use the word freed market instead of free market. So I really appreciate when you say pure market, because I think what you're trying to drive at is more specificity so that the language consensus is much more clear. It's one of the reasons why I say that I'm an abolitionist. The reason I say I'm an abolitionist is because Wilberforce and the rest of the 19th century abolitionists were probably the antecedents to the modern libertarian movement, and may even be the antecedents to the libertarian movement that we have today, both minarchist and anarchist. So what I've discovered is that if we practice that kind of specificity when we're employing our language, the conversation not only gets deeper, but it gets more clear.
Yeah. I just don't like free market because it's been co-opted by people who want to shut down free markets or regulate them.
Exactly. Which is why I like freed markets.
Some people are saying the market, but I don't think that's specific enough. I like pure market. I like freed market. Ben Stone
and so
has...
people think that's the place I get my groceries.
Yeah. Ben Stone has a good term for the Liberty movement. He's calling it the Liberty mission now, which I have... pros and cons with, but I think it works better than Liberty Movement because it's so, movement sounds so collectivist to me and mission sounds individual. And I do live and breathe this stuff to the point where I'm barely working my day job anymore at home because I'm spending so much time producing Liberty Media that, you know, pays less than minimum wage, but it's what gets me out of the bed in the morning. And it's what gets me keeping going forward, and it's what I want to do. So it is, I'm on a mission.
Yeah.
So redemption in the third act, we need about 18 yes. minutes of hope for the future.
Okay. Now remember this hope is going to be, it's going to be tainted slightly with a lot of trudging, hard work, miscalculation, and everything that happens in the chaotic environment of spontaneous order.
All right.
Because in the end, what we're looking at here is while these total surveillance states around the country and around the total surveillance states around the world, and particularly in the U.S. and the U.K. when we look at them, are coming to the fore. We've got the collection farms in Utah. We've got 25% of all CCTVs in the United Kingdom. We've got the kind of almost Minority Report type Philip K. Dick pre-crime that's going on. I consider drunk driving, for instance, to be a pre-crime and essentially a non-crime in the world that I would live in. What we also have is a huge disaggregation. I'm working on my master's right now, and one of the I have to read a tremendous amount during the week, and one of the articles really caught my eye that I read this last week. They were talking about 911, and there was I think it was the Secretary of Defense at the time, had told Bush when 911 happened.
Why do you call it 911 instead of 911?
I don't know.
I thought maybe there was a hidden meaning to that. Because most people call it 9/11, don't they?
Hidden meaning.
Okay.
And by the way, I rarely dip my feet, much less take a dip into the conspiratorial feet. So when it comes to JFK, 9/11, the birther controversy, all that stuff, I really don't have much to contribute, and others would contribute much more vociferously to that than I can.
Okay.
9/11, he said, no transnational or non-state actor could have pulled this sophisticated a stunt off, this kind of terrorist act that occurred, 9/11, 9/11. Well, it turns out that it was a non-state actor that pulled it out. But what that also tells you is that the moral and political imagination of the rulers around the planet is such, they confine themselves to thinking in their conceit and hubris that only a sophisticated, in their minds, and I put that in quotation marks, only a sophisticated nation state could put together that kind of thing. There's a place that's 2.5 million square kilometers in Southeast Asia over several countries that's referred to as Zomia by anthropologists. It's what people refer to as a state repellent space, as an undergoverned space, as a non-governed space. And what you'll find in a lot of the strategic government documents that have come out of the U.S. and the U.K. from 2005 to 2012 are becoming increasingly alarmed and cognizant of how do we take care of these non-governed spaces, these undergoverned spaces. What are we going to do about that? How are we going to pay attention to that? Because it's not within their moral or political imagination or framework to envision that kind of thing happening. Because what is the largest foreign policy export of the United States right now?
Drones.
Besides drones, I'll give you that. It's the idea of large central governments landing on top of undergoverned, non-governed, or what they would refer to as chaotic nation states, installing those, and everything will be well. Western democracy will bloom, women's rights will be enhanced, and everybody will be on a yellow brick road to monetary prosperity. That's the line that we hear, but that's not the reality of what's happening. We've spent more than $1 trillion, I don't have a number, and I don't even think the U.S. government has a number, more than $1 trillion over a 12-year period of time in Afghanistan on a country that has a per annum GDP half of the 51st state in the union. I say 51st state because of D.C. That's the way, when they calculate GDP in the United States, they say D.C. and 50 states. Vermont is at the bottom of that heap. Yet Afghanistan, less foreign national aid, generates about $10 billion per annum in the above-ground economy. Now, I would tell you that Afghanistan is an imaginary country, always has been, always will be, and it's something to be admired. So after 12 years, $1 trillion, in the capital city of Kabul, you would be hard-pressed to cross the street between bases without being in full protective equipment, or up-armored Humvees or up-armored SUVs, whatever the case is, armed to the teeth. It can't be done, and it isn't done. So that's got to tell you something about the efficacy, not only of this foreign policy establishment, of plopping these central government monstrosities on top of countries that want nothing to do with that, but it also tells you that this whole aggregation of one world governments, central government, government supremacy, government having the upper hand and all that, when you look at the periphery, there's a whole lot of stuff going on when it comes to non-state actors, undergoverned spaces, non-governed spaces, underground economies, black economies and such, where spontaneous order is occurring in a fashion that is beyond the ken and the ability of the government to control.
Well, I actually think that we have more free speech in America than we've ever had. And I think part of it is the technology. Just they couldn't do anything about it. They didn't picture the internet becoming what it was. And that's contributing to underground economies too. You know, Bitcoin, a lot of people say, is the great hope for the underground economy. I'm not so sure, but I think it's a very interesting idea. And the United States Department of Commerce, I don't remember what alphabet soup agency it was recently, a couple days ago, issued it wasn't a law, it wasn't a bill, it wasn't a directive, it was called guidance about dealing with virtual currencies. So I think once they try to do something about it, that means it's working.
Look, they're terrified of virtual currency. They're terrified of, for the same reason that the EU Central Bank is terrified of what recently happened with the Cypriot banks. I think they made a tremendous political miscalculation. And some of my colleagues say, well, maybe they were also conducting a test of sorts to see what the reception would be to what's happening with that. I think that when it comes to, is it conspiracy or is it incompetence that causes the government to do what it is? I always vote for incompetence when it comes to this, because I think that not only what I mentioned earlier about the limits on the moral and political imagination and frameworks that they can envision, because they can't envision free people doing things with virtue to each other without being threatened with a stick. It simply isn't within their philosophical vision in Moscow on the Potomac or in any capital region around the planet that embraces collectivism. They don't see the world that way. By being blind to the way the world actually works, by being blind to the kind of everyday anarchy that every human on Earth participates in, and they're virtuous and moral in the process, reaching out to our families, helping out friends, getting together at the shooting range, a friend needs money to get by on groceries, or they need help with getting their car fixed, and you spend 2 hours fixing their car. We don't do that because we're being threatened with force to do that or else. We're doing that because we have a moral compass that is distinctly different from that of our rulers. Because our rulers, by and large, are sociopaths and psychopaths. And they follow what more learned people than myself can tell you are the character traits that engender being a sociopath or a psychopath, which would include not having empathy for what you do to others and not projecting the second and third order effects of what you're visiting upon people beyond how it enriches you as an individual. I mean, talk about self-interest taken to a psychotic level. Politicians are probably the worst offenders.
Yeah. Have you read that book? God, what's the name of the book? It postulates that 6% of all people are sociopaths and like 14% want to follow sociopaths. Political Polarology.
I haven't read the book, but I would agree with it.
Yeah. Give or take a couple percent, I think that's probably about right.
I most people are followers, though, because we've almost developed a form of moral cowardice that is encouraged by the government enclaves and rulers that oversee us. I mean, if we didn't have moral cowardice, then some people would step up and do the right thing. And government never wants individuals to do the right thing unless it's the right thing that is government stamped and approved. So I think in the end, Michael, I guess what I'm trying to say is that this Orwellian 1984 Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, Philip K. Dick nightmare that so many people envision, I think that the atomistic, deaggregated, spontaneous order that is most of humanity's, humanity either trying to get by or whatever the case may be. It's like the character in the first Jurassic Park movie said. He said, you know, you can try to control this. You can. But in chaos theory and complexity theory, it's such that nature will find a way. And what I'm saying here, to paraphrase, is that spontaneous order will find a way. We don't have alcohol terrorists. We don't have nicotine terrorists. We do have narco-terrorists. The reason we have narco-terrorism and the reason why we have narco-criminal organizations is because the government gave them a golden opportunity to conduct their business in the fashion that they do by making their product illegal.
Yeah, people just don't get it. And I'm amazed how many scientists understand natural order in everything but organizing humanity in the way they think governments need to.
It's funny because I used to get Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptical Inquirer. I consider myself I used to be a PsyCop member of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation Claims of the Paranormal, which James Randi had a standing offer of $100,000 or maybe even $1 million.
Oh, it was
for anybody.
A million. It was a million at one point, yeah.
A million for any psi phenomenon. Yet, so I enjoyed that part of it, but then they were so collectivist in their worldview, and I thought to myself, what is going on? Talk about cognitive dissonance. You can be skeptical of psi phenomenon, and I think any rational human being should be, yet you're not skeptical of your almost religious idolatry of government supremacism?
Yeah. Yeah, one place I've really noticed that is in the operating system Linux, which is pretty amazing. One of the co-creators, shall we say, of Linux, Richard Stallman, or as he calls it, GNU/Linux, is basically a socialist. And he was partially in charge of this project that I think is one of the greatest proofs ever that you don't need governments. I mean, all these people around the world voluntarily got together, created this stunning operating system, and improved it and improved it and improved it. It's been estimated that that operating system, if produced in a software company, would have cost $8 billion with a B dollars. And it was done voluntarily, and it works. And I just don't understand how someone who could oversee a project like that would believe that we need governments to organize humans into behaving the way they should.
Well, there's an apocryphal story about a river that kept overflowing near this city. And I wish I could find the origin of the story. But the story goes like this, and I'll say it very quickly. The government came in and said, you need to unscrew that because it keeps flooding the plain and such. And we're going to start a study. 5 years later, they've spent millions of dollars on a study to see what they're going to do. Finally, in 2 days' time, residents take the initiative, go there, unclog it with their own tractors and bulldozers and such. Problem solved. And you and I can probably think of hundreds of examples just like that, where the government seeks to do something in such a dysfunctional and ineffective fashion that what they essentially achieve, and I think this happens a lot, is a medical term called iatrogenic effect, which means achieving exactly the opposite of what you set out to do. Now, mind you, I think going back to our earlier conversation about the Constitutional Convention, there was nothing iatrogenic about that. I think Washington and Hamilton had something very cunning and malevolent in mind when they put that together, despite the propaganda that we've been taught in the government education camps, and that was to create a brilliant national mythos that would allow the government to grow at an exponential pace and still conflate that with freedom of the individual.
Yeah, what I think of more and more lately is examples where people have gotten together to do things voluntarily and governments have blocked them. Like in New Hampshire, where the power went out for 11 days and people fired up their generators to help themselves and their neighbors, and they got tickets for noise for running a generator. Or in Texas a couple years ago when there were wildfires and volunteer fire departments showed up and FEMA sent them home and said, you're not authorized.
And volunteer fire departments, by the way, are 85% of all firefighting forces in the U.S., despite what the fire unions say.
Yep. Well, we got a couple minutes here for summation and final hardcore redemption in the third act, if you got that.
Here's the hardcore redemption. You ready?
Yes.
People have to...
Wait. I got to take off my minarchist hat. Okay, go ahead.
People have to expand their horizons, and they need to get their critical thinking tool sets out. They need to concentrate on preparing for the worst, because that's happening, whether through economic collapse, government mismanagement, whatever the case may be. Did I say government mismanagement?
That's a redundancy. It's a, repetitive redundancy.
It is. And most of all, what I've learned is that people have to look beyond the shores of the United States for expat opportunities and start traveling if they have the wherewithal to do so. It doesn't take a whole lot of money to travel to places. Having been throughout Southeast Asia myself, you can live very cheaply in Kampuchea, what was once Cambodia. I was just in Indonesia in August. Vietnam, I've been there. You can live very cheaply there. As a matter of fact, Jeff Berwick, I mentioned earlier for the Dollar Vigilante, he has magically been able to finagle some kind of deal with the king of Kampuchea where you can buy a passport for $80,000. And I know that sounds like a lot of money, and it probably is, but it's a quarter of what it would cost you to do that in St. Kitts and Nevis. But there's other passport programs that are available. People need to expand, I've said this before, expand their philosophical and moral imaginations beyond these United States and consider other destinations, whether they visit them, they expat for a short period of time, or they decide to live elsewhere. To me, there are very few things that are more mind-expanding than removing yourself from the culture that you've been so encapsulated in and comfortable in and going to something that's almost alien and the kind of things you can find out about both yourself and the people you're visiting.
Excellent. I really appreciate having you on. And we like to end interviews on the Anarchy Gumbo podcast by saying worms. Would you indulge me in saying worms?
I will do that. Worms.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
All with a rotating guest on a spit barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.